You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to almost 1 million deaths in the United States over 2 years. That's, of course, the most direct impact, but there are myriad ways the virus has diminished the quality of our lives in other respects. One impact has been on mental health, as more of us feel isolated, less connected, and rates of anxiety and depression have clearly risen without as of yet a full accounting. Many of us, in the quest to stay safe from COVID exposure, have limited our activities, which includes often regular exercise. My guest today would like to see us get back on the horse, so to speak, or if we've never been on it, take our first tentative steps toward doing so. Jennifer Heiss is a cognitive neuroscientist who runs the NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. She's written a new book called Move the Body, Heal the Mind, and it's written very accessibly to help all of us couch potatoes start or start back on exercise as a regular habit. Even mild exercise has numerous health benefits. As Heiss shows in the book, her lab has demonstrated the benefits of exercise on mental health, sleep, even reversing the process that can lead to dementia. Exercise also enhances ideational fluency, the very basis of creativity. And lest you think Heiss is preachy, she details her own personal struggles with getting to exercise, including difficulty with her own emotions and relationships that led her to discover exercise as a huge source of multifaceted benefit, both personally and professionally. Dr. Jennifer Heiss, author of Move the Body, Heal the Mind, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Jennifer Heiss, welcome to Medical Monday. I'd love to start by just having you tell us about how moving the body is so important and why you tackle early on in the book why it's so hard to make it a habit. It's because our brains seem like they're hardwired for us to sort of avoid exercising. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this is a relic of our evolutionary past when we needed to expend a lot of energy to hunt and gather food. And so it was advantageous to conserve energy. And so the brain is set up to actually avoid moving at extravagant expense. And if life doesn't depend on it, it would rather you stay still. And so essentially the brain makes us lazy. And so if we flash forward to today's day and age when we don't need to move to survive, we can just hop in the car and go to the grocery store. You know, the necessity to move to feed ourselves and to survive is out of the equation. And so it's hard. The brain sees exercising as an extravagant expense. And so it goes out of its way to prevent you from doing that, be it, you know, saying to you things like, do we even have time to exercise today? Or aren't you tired? Do you even have the energy to work out? And so my book talks about this point. The brain makes it hard for us to be active. And I think that can help take some of the guilt out of, you know, some of us who aren't maybe as active as we should be or even want to be. You know, this narrative happens even when we want to exercise. And so I offer some suggestions in the book to how to overcome our lazy brain. And they're quite simple. You know, simply it's like planning ahead, putting it in your calendar, blocking it off, making the time ahead of time so that when your brain says, do we even have time to exercise? You can say, yeah, it's right here. It's right in my calendar. Or if your brain says, you know, oh, I'm too tired today. Let's just skip it. You can say, no, the workout today is not that hard. I've planned it out. It's right here. And so, you know, this simple strategy of planning ahead, making it easier for yourself in the moment helps you to overcome that biological inertia.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that that is so relatable. Like, I think that many of us in the real world, I guess, who know, we all know it's important to exercise. And yet those sort of mental hurdles, that inertia is very hard.
It's not a new message for sure that exercising is good for us. It's good for our body. And I think the message in the book is, you know, exercise is not just good for your body. It's good for your mind, too. And my hope is that this gives people extra incentive to put it in their calendar and start making, you know, making the time and space for exercise in their life.
Yeah. And you actually talk a lot about that, about how it's so important for mental health as well as physical health. And you have a chapter on that and are pretty frank about the fact that I think anywhere from, I guess, a third to a half, many people who take very commonly prescribed antidepressant medications, you know, usually the most common ones, the so-called SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, they're pretty ineffective for a significant, or you call them, you know, or I think the literature, we call them non-responders. And what's optimistic here is that, you know, even in your lab, you demonstrate or you know from the research that exercise essentially is an antidepressant. And you go into a little bit in a very, very readable, user-friendly, layperson way at talking about some of the brain and biochemistry about endorphins or endocannabinoids, some of the benefits that we can get from exercise. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Yeah, so I think it's surprising to a lot of people to hear the fact that antidepressants don't work for everyone who take them. And we're not talking about a small amount of people. We're talking about one third of people who take antidepressant drugs don't actually experience any relief. And so if they're not aware that that's a possibility, you can imagine how hopeless and that could feel. You know, you're doing what your doctor told you to do, you're taking your medication, but nothing is changing and you feel worse. And so the benefit of exercise is so tremendous for people like this who, yeah, we call drug-resistant non-responders. And when we look at individuals who have this form of depression, they respond significantly better to exercise than they do to the medication. And it seems like why that's happening is because their depression is caused by a different source. So the SSRI drugs, what they do is they increase the availability of serotonin in the synapse so that the brain has more available to make it calm, send the calming messages across its network. But individuals who have drug-resistant depression, they have serotonin. That's not their problem. And one potential problem is high levels of inflammation in their body. And so where did that come from? Well, as many people know, inflammation is part of the immune system, and it can come from being sick, whether it's being, you know, having a virus or being sick with a bacteria, or even chronic health conditions can cause elevated levels of inflammation, like heart disease, even some forms of cancer. But the for most of us, a real source of high levels of inflammation has to do with chronic stress. And I think especially now after, you know, the state of the world right now, you know, coming off of a pandemic and into a war, I mean, the world and the news is so negative. It's, you know, it's stressful. Even if we're not directly affected, it wears on us emotionally. And that emotional toll can actually start damaging the cells and creating this inflammatory response in the body that moves to the brain and inflames the brain, causing symptoms of depression and anxiety.
Okay, let me reintroduce you here. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Jennifer Heiss, who directs the NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada. She is a trained cognitive neuroscientist and it works in a department of kinesiology. And I was actually curious about that. It's because I read where you did a postdoctoral fellowship in brain science and aging. And how did that translate into this interest in kinesiology and movement? That's pretty, I love the combination. So you're actually, I mean, this book that you've written, which I forgot to mention the title of, the book is called Move the Body, Heal the Mind, which ties together how important it is to move the body in order to try to maintain and gather back homeostasis or balance in your life. How did you wind up going in that direction?
It's kind of a personal story, actually. So it happened during my grad studies. So I, as you mentioned, I was studying the fundamentals of neuroscience, so understanding how we represent memories and how we represent who we are in our brain. And it became quite clear to me that something wasn't right with my own brain. I was experiencing some severe bouts of anxiety, and I had gone to, you know, see the school doctor, and it wasn't what I needed or wanted that was being prescribed. And so on a whim, I borrowed a friend's rusty old road bike, and much to my surprise, those movements, those cycling rides really soothed my mind, and it made a total shift in my personal life. So before that, I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't really active. And after that, I really made it a priority to incorporate into my life because it really was the medicine that I needed. And so, you know, that personal transformation sparked a shift in my professional life too. And so like you mentioned, I started studying the effects of aging on the brain, and a major impact of dementia risk, our dementia risk, is inactivity. And in fact, research from my lab shows that physical inactivity can contribute to our dementia risk as much as our genetics. And so this real important factor of physical activity became sort of front in not just my personal life, but my professional life. And then I was fortunate enough to get this position in the kinesiology department, where since then I launched the NeuroFit Lab, and we've been intensely studying the effects of exercise on the brain ever since.
Well, yeah, you mentioned there dementia, and actually that's sort of one of the kind of bold claims. The subtitle of the book's Overcome Anxiety, Depression, and Dementia, and then Improve Focus, Creativity, and Sleep, all of which are very appealing aspects. And it's sort of, you read that and you think, wow, if I just exercise regularly, I can sort of get these multiple wins, which is what I like. Mm-hmm. But I was most intrigued perhaps by the dementia claim. So share with us more about that, because I'm definitely familiar with some of the literature around how important exercises for mental health and, you know, can diminish or help control anxiety or depression. But dementia, and so you give examples of people in your lab who have what's known as mild cognitive impairment. And this is where people have a little bit of trouble with memory or a little bit of trouble with what's called praxis, like remembering how to do things. But those that were in a cohort that engaged in some kind of regular exercise, and one of the key points here is it doesn't have to be triathlons, right? It can be just very mild forms of exercise, mild forms of movement. Mm-hmm. And they have really remarkable sort of recoveries, if you will, or outcomes. And so I guess I would love you to share the science with us.
Yeah, so that's a really fascinating study that looked at people who had mild cognitive impairment. And it's, you know, people who have this diagnosis, you know, they're declining faster than would be expected given their age, but they don't quite have dementia yet. So it's sort of in between a healthy aging and dementia. But what's really amazing and hopeful and promising is that people with MCI, they can revert back to normal. And this often happens when we deal with the physical ailments, like high blood pressure, for example. And one of the best ways to manage high blood pressure is with physical activity. And so there is a study that shows the reversion rate back to normal from MCI is higher in a resistance exercise training group than in a control group who didn't exercise. And so I think this is such a powerful message that we do have control over our brain health. And things like dementia are pretty scary. And there's no drug that targets and can cure it. And so I think promoting this idea, letting people know about how strong the research is on exercise for dementia prevention, is the way that we need to go to kind of demystify the aging brain and help support it as we age.
Yeah, and you give several, you know, very inspiring examples of, I'd say, septuagenarians or even octogenarians who run, I guess, the Boston Marathon was one example. Mm-hmm. But so some of our listeners are, you know, in the older age category. What are some basic or starting even recommendations you make? Mm-hmm. And you have plenty of recommendations in the book. And I should highlight that after each chapter, there's sort of a 1 or 2 page recommended set of workouts for mild or moderate. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the end of the book has some nice photographic exhibits of you and your loved ones actually demonstrating some of these exercises. And it's nothing too fancy. I mean, it's not even, you know, belonging to a gym or a high-tech sports equipment. I mean, some of it's pretty simple stuff. Can you just share those ideas with us?
Yeah, so I think this is a really special feature of the book where I took all the science and I formulated these exercise workouts, so science-inspired workouts that really take the literature and, you know, create and compose it into this workout. And there's aerobic workouts, but also strength training workouts and flexibility workouts. And they don't require any, as you said, any fancy equipment or access to a gym. So I tried to make them really inclusive and accessible. One specific form of exercise that I always recommend to the older people that I love in my life is this form of walking, because most older people like walking. It's very accessible and it's very enjoyable, something you can do with your friends or your partner. And the thing with walking, though, is many older people like to walk, you know, at a conversational pace. bit of a slower, you know, have a chat with your friend. And we just need to pick up the pace a little bit, just intermittently. And I call it, it's interval walking. And in the book, it's the wellness walk plus. And so research from my lab shows that this form of interval walking, where you walk at a regular pace for 3 minutes, and then you pick it up for about 3 minutes, and then you go back to regular pace for 3 minutes, pick it up for three, and kind of alternate between the fast and slow pace. This form of interval walking boosts memory. It's really good for boosting memory. And we showed that in seniors who hadn't been exercising. So we had them work on a treadmill, but you can do this outside. It's just a really fun way to work out. And I mean, if you forget to count the time, what you could do is just like pick it up between light posts or add in a hill or two to your walk, which you normally wouldn't do, and just making sure that you get that intensity up a little bit. And so the reason why getting the intensity up is, one reason is that it produces lactate, the accumulation of lactate in the muscles. And now you've probably heard of lactate or lactic acid, and it's typically associated with sort of a painful burning sensation in the muscles. But it turns out, this is one of the most surprising findings, is that lactate is actually maybe one of the greatest promoters of neuroplasticity. So it travels from the muscle to the brain and targets specifically the hippocampus, which is the brain region we need for memories. And it's also the one that's damaged by Alzheimer's disease. And what lactate does at the hippocampus is it promotes the growth of newborn brain cells throughout our lifetime. So even at the end of life, we're producing newborn brain cells, and exercise increases that propensity.
It's amazing. It's just, it's like such a recent sort of discovery, I guess, because for centuries, I would say, or maybe not that long, but I mean, as long as we've, you know, modern medical science, if you consider like the late 19th century on into the 20th century, you know, we thought that the brains formed kind of in utero, the neurologic system, and then early childhood, the brain developed, and then that was kind of it. You might have hit, depending on what age, you know, whether it's 15 or 21 or 30, but it was all downhill from there. And that's, we've shown that's not true. I mean, that's kind of a very invigorating.
It's not true. Yeah. You do the most rapid forms of development and growth in childhood and adolescence. It peaks around 25, 30. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to, you know, fall off the cliff right there. We can maintain a really high level of functioning throughout our life by engaging in healthy living, like being physically active, being socially active, being engaged.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Jennifer Heiss, who directs the NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. She's author of Move the Body, Heal the Mind, which is a distillation of science around the importance of exercise for many of the things that afflict us as a modern society, including anxiety, depression, memory troubles, but further goes on to suggest not only that exercise is beneficial for those conditions, but can improve our focus, creativity, and sleep. And Jennifer Heiss, sleep is something that I think as I've gotten older, it's become more dear and precious because for some reason it's harder to achieve. Yeah. So tell us how.
It's hard.
Yeah. Well, one thing I learned, you introduced the term to me, chronotype, which is kind of what it sounds like. We fall into different chronotypes. That is basically, I think a simple way would be like, oh, we're like night owls or we're morning people. Is that kind of a safe?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Okay. So chronotype. How does exercise benefit? I mean, some of it's sort of fairly logical. You tire yourself out, you're going to sleep better. But what are the sort of brain benefits of regular exercise? And like, explain to us maybe how the science works.
Yeah, so around chronotypes and specifically, there's some really fascinating research that shows we can exercise right for our chronotype. So if we look across the lifespan, most of us fall into sort of a mid-level chronotype. But like you said, there's like the night owls and the early birds. And, you know, in adolescence, we're most likely to be a night owl. And so this poses a real challenge for teens who need to get up for school in the morning, right? And on the other end of the lifespan, we have, you know, older adults who may be getting up too early and like well before the crack of dawn and may want to push their sleep a little bit later. And so you can use exercise to help you either wake up earlier or go to bed later. And based on the evidence, if you exercise in the evening, this will help you, you know, sleep longer into the morning. And if you exercise in the morning or early afternoon, this can help you wake up earlier. And so you can sort of titrate or plan your exercise depending on what you need for your chronotype, which I thought was really fun. But the bottom line with exercise for sleep is that the more we move during the day, the better we sleep at night. And in the book, I talk about how that works. And there's some really fascinating science around, you know, the use of ATP to generate adenosine and the brain using adenosine as the sleep switch. But also like what many people are familiar with, like, so the biological clock and how it ticks longer than 24 hours. Actually, it's 24.2, and how we can use exercise in the sun to help reset that clock every day.
Thank you. Well, I want to pivot a little bit to another one of your chapters, which is an important one. And you have a chapter about addiction. And there's mm-hmm. sort of two aspects to this that I thought were really interesting. And I thought, I didn't think you could talk about the importance of exercise for essentially controlling or getting over addiction. And by, you know, addictions, we're talking about common chemical dependencies like substances, alcohol, illicit drugs that people, you know, unfortunately get physiologically and psychologically addicted to. And so exercise can be extremely beneficial for people who are in recovery. But I was curious, and indeed you did then raise the question of what about this whole notion of addiction to exercise itself? And you have a pretty nice treatment of that. And in fact, I think that, you know, you're a good example, and you're very open in the book about the fact that you had periods in your life where you weren't exercising, and even gasp, you smoked at one point in your life. I was shocked to read that. But you know, you've come a long way to where, where you're now a triathlete, right? So you're training pretty vigorously a lot of the time for triathlons. Mm-hmm. So and I think it's reasonable to ask any triathlete, you know, do you have an exercise addiction? Because you have very mm-hmm. regimented training, you're scheduling your trainings, you have to do three sports. But also, you know, the cross training part of that, the weightlifting or the mm-hmm. plyometric stuff. So, first of all, it turns out, I guess, that based on the literature, exercise addiction is not as common as we might think it is, right?
Yeah, no, it's not very common even among athletes. So it's they estimate it to be about 3% or less. I mean, I think that's generous. Now, I will say that it can be higher among people who have an exercise addiction as part of an eating disorder. And that's different. So that's more, it's the exercise becomes a punishment. And that's obviously very not helpful. But when we look at like a pure exercise addiction, it's so rare, like less than 3% of the general population. And I think it was less than 5% of athletes, even like CrossFitters, who everyone knows, like really into their sport. It's only 5%. And so the idea, I had actually done a test of an exercise addiction on myself. It's not in the book. I had it in like an earlier version, but I filled out one of the classic tests to screen for exercise addiction. I had one of my triathlon friends do it too. And both of us came out addicted to exercise. And then I was like, wait a second, I don't know about this. So we unpacked it a little bit. And there's a lot of controversy around how we measure it, right? Because when you're training and dedicated to a sport, you know, you are exercising, you're following a plan. It's not out of control, you know? So there's these four C's of addiction. You're craving it. It's compulsive, like you can't help but do it. It has negative consequences on your life. And that one in particular, when we look at exercise addiction, it's hard to meet that often. So, you know, if it's not causing harm, it can't be an addiction. And I think that's an important message to say. So just because you enjoy something and you're doing it a lot doesn't necessarily mean it's an addiction. This point around, is it causing harm? And if not, then it's likely not an addiction. So I think that's really helpful. And I mean, it makes sense when we look at the population, you know, unfortunately now, especially addiction rates are really high and exercise rates are really low. I mean, if we just look at, you know, how addictive is this, but there's really amazing research showing that, as you mentioned, not only can exercise help the brain recover from an addiction, opening up the reward system faster, but it also can help youth prevent addiction by giving their brain the dopamine it seeks, like that rewarding feel-good feeling. And if we flood the brain with dopamine from exercise, teens are less likely to seek it out in drugs or other unhelpful behaviors.
Yeah, I think you summarized it really well in a very succinct chapter. There's one other chapter I really wanted to touch on, which is toward the end of the book, is about creativity. And this was just pleasant, very optimistic to read. And it was a good way to, I think, probably end the book, which was, how is it that exercise enhances creativity? And again, I think some of it is probably, you know, seems obvious or logical. But again, you have some of the scientific detail that really is encouraging around how doing different forms of physical activity can enhance whether it's our ideational frequency, like how often we get ideas, how original our ideas are, or the quantity of our ideas. And so it just enhances sort of this brain function. And I think I've sort of personally found this to be true, but I was wondering if you could shed some light on the science around it.
Yeah, and this is a really nice piece of science because you can just have a self-paced walk. I mean, you don't need to train intensely for this one. It's just a 10-minute walk has been shown to improve creativity. A 30-minute yoga session, a jog, taking the stairs, really anything. And the idea is most of the time we're sitting still, and these days in front of a screen. And so the idea is that not only does the movement get you up and get the brain blood flowing, and this helps improve focus, but you're doing something unique and different, and this is where creativity gets really trained. So by doing activities or taking a different route or moving your body in a unique way, it helps promote mental flexibility. So if you're anything like me, I mean, I'm so routine oriented. I take the same walking route. I go to the same gym. I do it at around the same time, and so kind of breaking up that routine a little bit, obviously always check with a healthcare provider if you're starting something brand new, but this idea of, trying to change it up, and this, not only does that train your body to do something different, but it also trains your brain. And I talk about some of the neural networks that are involved in either maintaining focus or promoting mental flexibility. And they typically tend to be oppose each other, but there are ways that through exercise, through creative movement, that we can bring them together.
Well, it's just part of a really cogent, interesting, and frankly fun read. It's called Move the Body, Heal the Mind, and it's by my guest today, Dr. Jennifer Heiss, who is the director of the NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Jennifer Heiss, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Dr. Jennifer Heiss is director of the NeuroFit Lab at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. Her new book is Move the Body, Heal the Mind. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.